It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus. Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Daily Premier League news and views. This is Football Social Daily.
Hello, how are you doing? This is Football Social Daily. I'm Jim, and this is your daily Premier League podcast, rocketing through the week this week, mainly because of the bank holiday in the UK, which means today feels like a Wednesday when it's actually a Thursday, but also because of the dizzying amount of midweek football that's been played this week, all of which we will cover off on today's podcast. Arsenal, back in the top four chase, Newcastle all but safe, and the title race is back on and back in Manchester City's hands as well, all as a result of last night's games. We'll go into more detail very soon. Plus, we've got a massive game for Burnley to look ahead to. Their first home game without Sean Dyche at the wheel. It comes against Southampton, and they are desperate for a win that would close the gap on rivals for relegation Everton. It would be just 1 point if Burnley can get a win tonight. We're also going to be looking at Old Trafford, where the club have condemned some of the songs sung by their fans during Manchester United's 4-0 defeat to Liverpool and promised to educate those offenders. But is there a bigger problem with football fans and behaviour at play here? We'll talk about that shortly as well. To discuss all that, a man who was hoping he wouldn't have to talk about that game or mauling against Liverpool again, Joel Tudor. How you doing, Joel?
Back on day three of the therapy session. I already did one yesterday, spilling my guts to it. Now I've got to go through it again. It's like PTSD.
We won't talk too much about what happened on the pitch. It'll be more about what happened in the stands, which, to be honest with you, I'm not sure is any better, but we'll get onto that shortly. And I'm sure a man who can't wait to talk about last night's victory for Newcastle United over Palace and reaching that magic 40-point mark as well. Marley Anderson, how are you doing, Marley?
I'm doing very well. I'm enjoying watching my team play football and win games every now and again. So, yeah, happy with last night's performance. I'm sure we're going to dissect everybody's performance one by one in the next hour, so sit tight.
Well, that's exactly what we're going to do now. We're going to go through last night's games. There were four in total. There's a lot of games to go through, so I thought we'd do something we've done before on Football Social Daily. We'll kind of do a one-thought review on each of last night's games. I'm going to get Joel and Marley to take it in turns to give their thoughts on the games one by one, starting with Joel and Chelsea 2, Arsenal 4. I didn't see this coming, Joel. Are Chelsea in danger now after their recent sort of dip in form? They're being a bit erratic of losing that top four place. Once it felt nailed on, it felt like it was going to be Liverpool, City at the top, Chelsea third, and then someone else fourth. But could Chelsea still slip up and drop out of that top four after results like this?
I was also massively surprised. I said on yesterday's podcast how I just don't have any hope for Arsenal when it comes to them playing against the bigger sides, especially away from home. But when you look at Chelsea's defence these days, I mean, I think they've conceded 11 goals at Stamford Bridge in the last three games, which is absolutely unheard of. I think if you remember when Jose Mourinho was the manager, they went a good 86 games undefeated in a row under his reign, and now they just seem to, I think Thomas Tuchel's been defeated 20, five times in 25 games at home, which I think tells you all you need to know about, especially the defence, because for them, it just seems to be completely crumbling. Obviously, I think one of the biggest missing factors was not having Antonio Rudiger in the defence. And Malang Sarr just had an absolute stinker yesterday. He was just all over the place. And obviously you have Andreas Christensen, who saw the ball bounce over him like it was Sunday league football. It brought back so many memories of a goalkeeper kicking it out and then suddenly it's over your head again. And we blame the pitch, and we had every right to, but I don't think Thomas Tuchel did in this occasion. But Chelsea, I thought that it was an absolute smooth sailing finish for them into the top three, but they are in a little bit of danger now of letting the bottom two below them catch up, because obviously Chelsea still do have a few tough games to go, and Arsenal still do have to play the North London Derby. They still do have to play Manchester United in the next game, so it's still going to be quite a tough ask, and I still do think that Chelsea will make it there eventually, but their defence is seriously letting them down at the moment, and that was quite the opposite last year.
What do you think it is for Chelsea?
I think it's...
Is it just like the distraction of the ownership thing? Because they were so solid defensively when Tuchel came in, and that, like you say, that's crumbled. They're maybe not scoring the goals they'd expect to score. Is it just that whole ownership thing that's serving to distract them, do you think?
I think it's a combination of a few factors. Obviously, their defence has been, like you say, one of the main points of how good they've been in the last year and a half under Tuchel, but I just think it's the fact that two of them are probably on their way out, where Antonio Rudiger and Christensen have already got their eyes on another club, which I think adds to their distractions even more than necessary. But I think definitely the off-the-pitch distractions, I think, are massive, and they have been massive. I mean, they have like a half-empty Stamford Bridge yesterday, and then you've got the fact that N'Golo Kante and Jorginho haven't been as effective as they usually have been. They were the two of the best midfielders in the world, I remember was describing them as, at the start of the season. And it seems as though N'Golo Kante's had like one of the worst months of his career in terms of his form. And Jorginho seems to be in and out of the side with injuries and form. I think they're in a bit of a transitional period, and obviously they paid $100 million for Lukaku and he's just not performed at all. It's just been a very miss of a season for Chelsea. They could have a silver lining with the FA Cup, but I just think it's the second half of the season in particular has been very tough on them mentally, I think.
Niall was in our message group on Slack last night questioning N'Golo Kante's recent form as well, so it's a shared opinion that he's not been at the races recently. Also interesting last night that Eddie Nketiah got on the goal scoring sheet. Two goals for him, although it does feel like his future still lies away from Arsenal. Mikel Arteta saying maybe he hadn't been that fair on the striker in terms of his selection so far this season. Let's move on though. Newcastle 1, Crystal Palace 0. Marley, is that the game that secures Newcastle United's Premier League status for at least another year?
At least. Yeah, it is. To be fair, we'd have probably been all right without, you know, if the season has ended sort of without that win sort of thing. But that 40 points is like the magical marker, isn't it? You know, everyone talks about it, and getting there, you don't go down with 40 points 99% of the time. So, yeah, to get there is massive, and to get there with what, 6 games to spare, I think it is now. So it's an insane turnaround from where we were. I mean, we were dead and buried. I think 5 points when Eddie Howe came in, 5 points from 14 games and no wins. To being on 40 points after 33 games, it's form that, if you put that over a whole season, to put it into context, you're talking 70 plus points, and that is, you know, good enough for third in the league. That's how well we're playing. Like, that's not like, I'm not saying we're the third best team in the league, but I'm saying we've showed that type of improvement.
So do you back yourself for Europe next season?
No.
Would you say Newcastle?
No, not at all. But I don't know, to be honest. Like, not no, but I don't know where we're going to finish. But I'm hoping, like, comfortably top half with another bit of money spent. I think there's been rumours about 50-odd million being spent this summer, which is not a massive amount. But I think we need another striker and another winger. And possibly another defender as well. But if we can get that in the summer, then you know, top half has to be the sort of expectation and a push in one of the cups maybe as well, because we haven't had that for a while and we haven't had the league security to even think about a proper like challenge in the cup sort of thing. It's been more of a distraction than anything. But yeah, I think with the way we're playing now, we've got the quality and the talent and the players to come back to really improve the side and finish in the top 10 comfortably next season. And the likes of, you know, Callum Wilson have still got to come into this team. And I was watching Chris Wood last night, and I just think with the way he's been doing a decent job for the team, but like last night he was shocking. He didn't do enough at all. And I just thought there's still Callum Wilson to come back, and if you can keep Callum Wilson fit for a full season, you know, in a team that's creating chances, he can easily score 15, 16, 17 goals in a season easily. So hopefully we get to see a full strength Newcastle before the end of the season with Trippier and Wilson coming back into the side. And we can sort of salivate about how good we might be next season and how where we might finish and so on, because not everybody has good seasons. You've seen it with Man U this season. They could finish 7th or 8th. West Ham might not reproduce what they are this season, next season. You know, there's a lot of sort of up in the air outside the top two. And can Newcastle push into that top 10 and be there if anybody really does have a big slip up?
There's a bit of debate, I guess. You mentioned kind of signings in the summer. Some of the signings that have already been made, their future potentially being questioned already. Are they the long-term options, players like Chris Wood? But you've got to say Bruno Guimarães looks the business in a Newcastle shirt, and he had another good game last night.
Yeah, he's far different to what we've had in the past 4 or 5 years, because he's so, like, he just reads the game better than everyone else. He's happy to get it in tight possession. Like, if he's got a man on his shoulder, he's not bothered about receiving the ball. He knows that he's there, and he knows not to turn into him, to play a first-time pass and get away from him and something like that, and keep the tempo high. And, you know, he's passed for... You see, in the goal last night, a lot's been made of Almiron's finish, and rightly so, because it was fantastic. But if you look at the chest control by Bruno, takes out Gallagher and takes him into a little pocket of space in midfield. But as soon as that ball hits the floor, Almiron is like 6 or 7 yards behind Tyrick Mitchell. But Almiron knows that Mitchell doesn't know that ball's going over the top. And he knows that Bruno's sticking it over the top for him. And he knows there's 30, 40 yards of space there. So it's that like understanding that we never had in the first 14 games of the season. Because we didn't have a manager that didn't rate tactics, which is as bizarre as anything. But it's, you see the understanding when with Bruno, you know, everyone knows he's got that killer pass and that quality and that vision to see it. And there's, you know, that's the reason why he's getting goals, he's getting assists. I think he's got 3 goals since he came in, and he's got the all important assist yesterday as well. So he's a quality player, and I think we've done very, very good business to get him. When he was linked with Arsenal and things like that, we've gone in and put our money where our mouth was and got ourselves a good player out of it.
Good news for Newcastle. Crystal Palace feel a little bit on the beach at the moment. Their results have been a bit hit and miss since February, really. Maybe not winning games you'd expect them to win, but then pulling out some results as well. So maybe they're already thinking about next season. Let's move on to Everton versus Leicester City. A late goal and a late draw for Everton, Joel. Massive point for Everton, courtesy of Richarlison at the very end. Puts them 4 points clear of Burnley for the time being. Burnley in 18th, obviously. But the next two games are Liverpool and Chelsea. So 100% not clear or safe yet by any stretch of the imagination from relegation. It might feel like points dropped last night, I think, for Frank Lampard, because if they'd beaten Leicester, it would have been 3 wins in a row. And I'm sure Frank Lampard potentially would have looked at that game and gone, this is one of the games where we need to pick up a win with the running we've got.
Yeah, I think it's been a really good reaction from Lampard's side, especially prior to the Man United game where they lost 3 in a row. It was looking like the inevitable was going to happen, and obviously you can bank on United to give a team a nice little 3 points to get the season going again. And that Everton one yesterday against Leicester, like you say, I think they definitely should have took more than a point out of it. I think Richarlison could have had at least 3-2 just himself. I think he missed an open goal where he literally hit it straight back to the keeper and he had the whole goal to aim for. But I just think it's been a really good reaction ever since they got beat by Burnley 3-2, which was that was a terrible result for them, just considering they're their direct rivals to be going down. I just saw a ridiculous stat, which was that Leicester had dropped 29 points from winning positions this season, which is pretty something considering when you look, well, it's quite telling when you look at the last two seasons and how they've managed to bottle the top four two times. It just seems as though they don't have the know-how to actually close games out. But Everton are in a really good position now. But it, like you say, the next few games are going to be really telling. Obviously, they've got to go to Anfield, which is not an easy task. Then they've got to go and play Chelsea at Goodison. And then they've got to play Leicester again. So it's not going to be easy. And obviously, they have Arsenal on the final day. And Arsenal will probably be battling for the top four. So it's still not a said conclusion yet, considering Burnley, I would definitely not count them out just yet. But it's been a good reaction and a good result. I think that was probably as good as a victory, just in terms of the manner that they did it in, where when your team scores in the last few minutes, it usually feels like a victory rather than just another 1 point towards it. I think it'll give them such a massive boost. The fans were going crazy at the end. You just saw limbs everywhere in Goodison. I think that'll feel more than a draw for them going forward. But like we say, the next two games, it could be dampened again, and they could be fighting for their lives depending on how Burnley do in the next few games.
Credit where it's due for Frank Lampard as well, bringing on Solomon Rondon and Dele Alli, and they did make the difference last night after the game. Lampard saying that maybe Dele Alli has a chance to make a difference in the season so far, even though he's not started a single game under Frank Lampard yet. I think that was a bit of a kind of like a public call out for Dele Alli to pull his socks up and make an impact at Everton from Frank Lampard.
Do you know what made me laugh about that game? You know, the winner. The fact that Solomon Rondon has been credited with an assist for that winner. For trying to trap the ball.
I haven't seen the goal, actually.
Oh, man. So the ball comes in, it's like a low cross from Dele Alli, who does really well, by the way, Dele Alli. But Rondon tries to trap it, like, and with his back to goal about 2 yards out, and the ball just rolls under his foot, and it clips his stud, and it goes to Richarlison behind him, and then he puts a deflected strike in and scores the goal. But I seen on the Sky Sports and stuff, they were giving like assist a Solomon Rondon, and I watched it, and I was like, that's gonna wind so many people up, because it's like, it sounds like a good sort of thing, like, yeah, oh, he's got an assist, brilliant, but he's actually just miscontrolled the ball and got really, really lucky that Richarlison was behind him. But so they all count, especially when you're down there. That's what you need to happen, because Everton are bang in trouble still.
You have to take those goals. Trust me, I know. You take those assists and those credits where you can when you've got a record like Solomon Rondon. Right, last game, Man City 3, Brighton 0, Marley. Now, City needed a big reply after Liverpool's win versus Manchester United earlier in the week. So did they get it versus Brighton? Did they get the response they wanted?
Yeah, I think they did. It was definitely getting twitchy after 50 minutes or whatever it was, when just before Mahrez scored. Because, you know, they were wasting chances in that first half. And I thought with the way it was going, you look at the crowd, and I said to one of my mates last night, who was a Man City fan, he said the goals were celebrated like with relief rather than joy. And I said to him, like, nobody enjoys a title race except the people that aren't in it and they can sit and watch from afar. You know, nobody enjoys it. It's, you know, it's just tension and, oh Christ, they won last night, so we've got to win tonight, and they've got these lot at the weekend, so we've got to beat these lot before them. Or reply after them, you know what I mean? It's all super high stakes. It's great to watch from our point of view, because, you know, as a non-Man City and Liverpool fan, it's great to just watch decent football and then slug it out for the title. But as for last night, I thought, you know, City were playing well. Like, there was nothing to worry about, because, like, they were always likely to score with that level of sort of dominance in the first half and the chances they were missing. It's always likely that one of those is going to go in. But you just think, like, is it going to be one of those days where you just get frustrated by a side that's fairly comfortable with the ball and can frustrate you a bit? And then when chances go begging, like Mahrez, when he had an open goal and decided to try and dribble rather than just fire it straight back in past Robert Sanchez, who'd made a terrible pass, you think, oh God, is that the is that a sign of what's to come? Is there more frustration on the way? But I always think with games like this, you need something to just... You either need some ridiculous quality or a mad bit of, like, luck. And I think they got that with Mahrez's goal because, I mean, I don't know how many deflections it takes. It's hard to even count because the ball's spinning and bouncing that much. That he sort of bundles his way past Lewis Dunk. The pass to him's deflected. And then even the finish that goes past Sanchez goes in off Joel Veltman. And it was one of them where it just broke everything. It broke the sweating that's going on in the crowd with them thinking, oh God, we're going to make a balls up of this. And it broke Brighton, basically, because Brighton don't score goals. I think that they've won the last two, but before that, they scored one goal since February before the last two games. They were never going to get back into it against a side as good as City. And then City sort of relaxed a little bit and got the second and the third goals with some decent quality and another bit of luck with Foden's strike as well. So, yeah, job done in the end, but it was a bit tetchy and it will be for the next few weeks until somebody in that title race drops points.
It does feel like the first half was a sign of how the rest of the season might go for Manchester City. Just that tension and that kind of... I don't know how to describe it, just that kind of not wanting to make a mistake. And Pep Guardiola did say after the game that he knows and his players know if they slip up at any point, if they draw a game instead of winning it, that's it. The title is Liverpool. Is he right in saying that? Is it a case of who blinks first for Liverpool City and then who goes on to win the Premier League title now?
I'd probably agree because with six games to go, it's not, you know, how many teams sort of chasing the title would lose many of those six games. I don't think there'd be any more than one. Having won, you know, what, 25, 26 of the previous 32, you wouldn't back them to lose more than one game. So I think draws are probably what it's going to come down to. You know, if Liverpool draw, it's a four-point gap if City then go and win. And then it's the other way. Well, it's not the other way around. If City draw, but Liverpool will have a clear sort of one point cushion if Man City draw and they win. And that is probably what it's going to come down to. I think City have got the slightly easier run in, but you know nothing certain when you look at teams and say, well, they've got nothing to play for. So will they turn up? And Everton are scrapping for their lives. So will they want to beat Liverpool and give their season? I mean, probably the best thing Everton have done all season if they beat Liverpool and stop them winning the title by far in terms of what their fans sort of rate as success. It'd probably be sticking a spoke in the Liverpool title race wheels. But City have got to go to places and you don't know whether the shackles are going to come off because people are on the beach, so to speak. They might just find themselves and play better when they're playing, you know, likes of teams that don't like that mid-table teams. I think City've still got to play Newcastle. I think Liverpool do as well. So you know, we could still have a big say in the race. But it probably will just come down to the next team to drop points, and then the other ones are the favourites, I would say. So I probably agree with what they're saying there.
There is one more game from this week's Premier League action to cover off. It's Burnley versus Southampton, Burnley's first home game without Sean Dyche, and we'll cover it off next on Football Social Daily.
Football Social Daily. Subscribe to the podcast now so you never miss an episode.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Football's Social Daily. Find more great sport at sport-social.co.uk.
Welcome back to Football Social Daily. We are talking Burnley versus Southampton. And because of the bank holiday, this is the first chance we've really had to talk about a Sean Dyche-less Burnley. We've not covered it off yet. And Marley has been desperate to get his teeth into this one. He's been singing all bank holiday weekend about the sacking of Sean Dyche. Does it feel like a panic, Marley, the fact that Burnley Football Club have made this decision with, what, 8 games to go of the season, when they've shown so much faith in Sean Dyche previously, to make the decision now to get rid of him with it, what doesn't feel like a clear vision on what happens next?
Yeah, in a nutshell, it's strange, isn't it? Because nobody expected this, did they? It wasn't rumoured by the press. It wasn't, demanded for by the fans. And then it just happened out of the blue, didn't it? On I think it was Saturday morning or Friday morning, one of the weekend Easter weekend things. But yeah, to be fair, for the last few weeks, I've been waiting for a sort of opportunity to talk about Burnley for some reason, and I wanted to mention, why is Dyche not under pressure with how Burnley are doing? Like, they're 18th. We know they always survive. They're a bit like a cockroach. Like, they will always survive, whatever it may be, because they've got Dyche and because they've got a plan. And when teams drop off towards the end of the season, they get better. And we're coming to that. And I think everybody knows that with Burnley, except the new owners. And the owners have come in and gone, and they've looked at it logically. To be fair, they've gone, we've had 30 odd games. We spent a bit in the summer with Corne. We spent a bit more in January with Weghorst coming in. And we're still rubbish. We're still 18th. We're still, you know, what was it, 4 points adrift of Everton right now. And they've gone, yeah, well, this isn't good enough. But they've stopped there. They've gone, this isn't good enough, let's get rid of him. They haven't gone, this isn't good enough, let's get rid of him and get this guy. Because, you know, it's been almost a week now, and I still don't even know who's the favourite for the job. For the Burnley job, I think there's been talks of Chris Wilder. There was someone talking about Michael Duff, who used to play for them, is now managing like Cheltenham or Chesterfield or something. And I was like, if that's the level of pond you're fishing in, then it's bizarre to sack him in the first place, because we all know that they get better towards the end of the season. And I think they've sealed their fate, to be fair. I think I was always reluctant to say, yes, Burnley will go, because of the Dyche factor, and the fact that he's so used to getting them out of the stuff when it comes to sort of squeaky bum time at the end of the season. But now they've got no manager, and the flipping centre-back's managing them. It just smacks of, we have no idea what we're doing. And I think, in all fairness, Burnley deserve relegation after this, and with the lack of money they've spent in the and the lack of chances they've taken in the past 7 or 8 years in the Premier League, I think their time's up, and I think they probably deserve relegation now. So let's see what happens. But this decision just makes very, very little sense. But Dyche doesn't care, because he was out on the piss on Sunday night over the Easter weekend. I think he was in Nottingham having a great time, so he doesn't care.
The irony is that if you're Burnley Football Club and you're looking at the situation you're in at the moment and the managers that are available, the manager that you want to come into Burnley Football Club who's available is Sean Dyche. that's the weird scenario they're in. But Chris Wilder's leading the odds at the moment. Wayne Rooney's in the mix. Sam Allardyce apparently was favoured by the club, which is just Sean Dyche from 10 years ago. They don't want him. Sam Allardyce doesn't want the job, apparently, so he obviously sees it as a little bit too difficult. It does feel like Burnley have backed themselves into a corner here a little bit, Joel. They've made decisions like the selling of Chris Wood,
and for want of a better word, it's gone tits up. So the board have to do something, and that thing that they've decided to do is sack Sean Dyche. But who does come in? It's very difficult to see how anything other than relegation happens from here, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the whole situation is just lacking a lot of transparency, because he was there for, 10 years, wasn't he? And he literally feels like he's been ushered out of the back door. Like, there wasn't a crazy video tribute. There wasn't a big thank you to him. It was all just very quiet. And
there was nothing.
It was, yeah, it's like he was literally just pushed aside and forgotten about. And for a guy who's literally kept them relevant under a shoestring budget, I think I had a bigger net spend when I went over to Lisbon, and he's literally had nothing to spend. So,
then prawns, like, they're expensive.
They're expensive on the Atlantic coast. But Dyche has literally been on a shoestring budget. I think this past transfer window, when they got Maxwell Cornier and Wout Weghorst, that's probably been the highest spend he's ever spent in around 10 years in a window, and that wasn't even that much, and that was on the back of losing his best striker. So for him to just be pushed out, I guarantee something major's gone on behind the scenes in terms of a dispute, a conflict between the board and Dyche, which has literally caused this very discreet exit, which is, I think, so disrespectful. Like I said, he's literally kept the club as a Premier League status club for all these years, and I don't think many other managers with that budget would be able to do the exact same job that he did. And I know he's very into the community in Burnley, and he's more than just the manager there, and I just think the way it's all gone about happening has just been very, very strange. Maybe it'll come out soon once he gets his £10 million payout, but I think, who do you go for now? Dyche was the perfect fit for Burnley. He represented Burnley to a T. And then now, I wouldn't be surprised if someone like Paul Jewell took over or someone like that, and they'll end up just like languishing in the Championship. Just, yeah, it's a strange move. I think they do have those new American owners, don't they, who took over not so long ago. I'm sure that had a massive say in what went on behind the scenes as well. I think that's had a massive influence. So, who knows? Ben Mee might end up taking the job as a player manager. Like, it doesn't shock me anymore, football these days. And he got a decent result at your place at West Ham. So who knows? I still wouldn't rule them out at all. I just think they have a cell that clicks when it comes to the last 8 games of the season. But the way in which it all went on has just been really distasteful on their end. But I'm sure more will come to light when he's allowed to speak contractually.
It'll be interesting to see what the reaction is like tonight at Turf Moor. I think there's likely to be more of a reaction from the fans than the players. They certainly didn't want Dyche to go. Even the pub that's around the corner from Turf Moor, the Royal Dyche, has said, "We're not changing our names, we're keeping that name going." For the Clarets, Ben Mee's missing, Eric Peters is missing, Goodmerton's missing as well. Ashley Westwood might be out. He faces a late fitness test. As for Southampton, only Alex McCarthy in goal is their only absentee. Now, if you look at Southampton's run-in, to spend a little bit of time looking at them ahead of this game, they've got a great run-in over the last few games of the season. The only team they face outside of the bottom 10 is Leicester City, who still feel very beatable. They could have a decent finish here, Southampton. They could finish in one of their best ever Premier League positions, couldn't they, Marley?
Yeah, I just want to... I like how you said Westwood faces a late fitness test, even though his leg was backwards against West Ham at the weekend.
Oh, really? Was it? Oh, yeah. That's a good point. I'm just reading direct off the BBC website, to be honest with you.
Tell you what, that'd be the quickest recovery from a leg that was literally on back to front on the turf on Saturday afternoon or Sunday afternoon, whatever it was.
Maybe he's grown a new one. Could have grown a new one. He might be all right.
Oh my God!
All right, well, let's assume he's out as well then.
Yeah, I'd say he's probably gonna miss the game. But yeah, Southampton.
He's awaiting a scan. Sorry, I misread it. He's not awaiting a fitness test. He's awaiting a scan. But yeah, you're right. Given the injury he faced at West Ham, it's probably going to be a long-term absentee.
Yeah, well, inside info on what the scan's going to say. It's absolutely knackered, mate. You're going to be out for at least eight or 10 weeks. But yeah, now going back to Southampton, I think I'm always sort of reluctant to think too deeply about Southampton, because they're one of them teams that when they get it right, they look really handy, and they play decent football, and they They've got threat and players that can hurt you, and they're a good sort of solid pressing team, and obviously the great quality from set pieces and things like that as well. But they don't seem to do it when you expect them to. So you can, I'm looking at them and saying, they've got a half decent run in where you can say they pick up points there, they pick up three or four wins maybe in those final few games, but it's Southampton. They don't do normal things. They lose when you expect them to win, and they win when you expect them to lose. So they've got Brentford, Palace, and Brighton coming up after this game, and you wouldn't back them to lose those games, but I wouldn't be surprised if they lost all three, because they're all over the place. But when they get it right, they're a decent side, and Breuer's been excellent for them this season. He's been probably one of the signings of the season in terms of impact compared to outlay. Getting him on a loan for a season, giving him the experience and what have you of a proper Premier League club, and he's repaid them with quite a few goals, because Southampton, I remember at the start of the season, I said Southampton could be in massive trouble here, because they sold the captain, Bertrand, to Leicester. They lost all the goals with Danny Ings. And the rest of the squad, they even sold Vestergaard to Leicester as well. So, they had a lot of holes to fill and to patch up. And I think, to be fair, no matter where they finish in the table, as long as it's not in the bottom three, which is nigh on impossible now, I think they've had a decent season, because we've seen what they can do on a good day. They just need to have more of those good days in the future and have another decent transfer window coming up and strengthen a bit before Hasenhüttl reportedly hangs up his cap and thinks about retiring.
What about Brozier as well then? Because I think he's been really impressive for Saints this season as well. He's on loan from Chelsea, as you say. Now, Chelsea have struggled to get a decent striker on board for years. They've spent big money on a load of players. They've never quite happened. I'd say the last real quality they've had up front was probably Didier Drogba. I'm not sure I can think of anyone since then who's really impressed. Could he go back to Chelsea and solve their striking problem? Could he lead the line with a Timo Werner and Havertz either side or something like that? Because Lukaku doesn't seem like he's really that interested this season.
Yeah, I think with Chelsea, I think they're probably in a position where they can't, well, they could, but they can't really go out and spend another huge fee on a striker to replace Lukaku in the summer. I think most of what they spend in the summer has to be what they might get if Lukaku can be sold. If they can sell him back to Inter for 65, 70 million, they'd probably accept that and say, just it hasn't worked. Get off our hands. We need the wages. We need the money. And I think if they can identify a striker as well, so if they got Lukaku out and give Breuer more of a chance next season, I think they've got the budget there to go and sign a different striker as well, so they can have Werner, Lukaku and somebody else. And they've also got a lot of big owners that they could sell on for profit to, well, not for profit, but for decent amounts to bulk them up a bit this summer, because Chelsea have got not a straightforward summer, because the players that are out of contract, Rudiger, Christensen, Azpilicueta is meant to be going. That leaves them with pretty much no centre-backs except a 38-year-old Thiago Silva. So they need to do a lot of work in defence. They need to sort out the Lukaku situation. They've still got Kepa Arrizabalaga on the books, who's taking up a lot of wages and might be worth a few quid to maybe a Spanish team who wants to come back for him. But in terms of Breuer, I definitely think there's a role there for him next season, because he's proved at a sort of the bottom half clubs that he can do the job and he can score goals in the Premier League. So I think if you put him in the Chelsea squad with better service and better players around him, you could easily see him getting 10 or 12 goals in all competitions next season and helping Chelsea out in the Champions League and their busier schedule, rather than rely on Kai Havertz to play a slightly unfamiliar centre-forward role and chip in with the majority of the goals. So I think there's a role for him there, and it's how the loan system can work well. We've seen it as well with Conor Gallagher doing something similar and to an extent Billy Gilmore at Norwich, but maybe not so much. But yeah, I mean, Chelsea have got plenty of opportunity for the guys who've been out on loan to come back in and state their claim for next season.
There's an interesting bit of breaking news where it comes to Chelsea as well. We won't talk about this today. We'll leave it for tomorrow's Football Social Daily. But apparently, Martin Broughton's bid to try and purchase Chelsea Football Club from Roman Abramovich has been boosted by involvement from Lewis Hamilton and Serena Williams, who are both interested in investing and backing the bid with cold, hard cash. So we'll delve into that a little bit more on tomorrow's Football Social Daily. And we'll finish today's Football Social Daily by looking back at Manchester United. Not the embarrassment on the pitch, but the embarrassment off it. We'll talk about it next on the podcast.
Football Social Daily. Find more great sport at sport-social.co.uk.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Football Social Daily. Subscribe to the podcast now so you never miss an episode.
Welcome back to Football Social Daily. The final bit of today's podcast we're going to spend looking back at Manchester United's mauling by Liverpool, much to Joel's dismay. It's not what we're going to talk about on the pitch, though. It's going to be focused on what's happened off the pitch during that game, because over the last 24 hours, Manchester United have condemned, as they put it, unacceptable behaviour from their fans. Hillsborough chants were sung at Old Trafford during that defeat by Liverpool, and you can understand the upset that has caused amongst the footballing community. Now, I'll read you the statement from Manchester United. A spokesperson said, "Manchester United stands in solidarity with Liverpool and its fans in remembering the victims of the Hillsborough disaster. Offensive chants about the tragedy are completely unacceptable, and we will work with our supporters groups to educate fans on the issue." Let's start with you, Joel, because you're a Manchester United fan and you probably no doubt felt anger. You no doubt were hurting after that result. But at the same time, I know you. You're a reasonable bloke, and I'm imagining you, even feeling that level of anger, realise that that is no way to behave. It is unacceptable to sing songs about events such as Hillsborough on a football terrace.
Yeah, it's not good. It's not good at all. I've seen it firsthand when I've been to, you know, United Liverpool games in the past, and it's always been the same with both sets of fans. It's just how fierce the rivalry is. And again, it's not like me condemning it. It's the fact that this rivalry has gone on for years and years and years. And when, like you say, emotions are running high and one team's getting the mick taken out of them, of course, I think it's going to antagonise one set of fans, as it has been. I think when you think back to maybe 10 years ago when Kenny Dalglish said after the incident with Ever and Suarez, how the fans were having like a good set of banter between each other. I think we've come a long way since then, where football clubs, the authorities are really starting to address or actually pay some light on the situation. I think in this situation specifically, the fact that prior to all of the chants being sung at the start of the game, when the whole of Anfield were actually up for Cristiano Ronaldo after he unfortunately lost his son a few days ago, I thought it was a really nice touch, that something that they definitely didn't have to do as well. So I think that's what probably led to an even bigger outrage than it probably would have, considering, like I say, it usually happens at most games between both sets of fans. And I think the fact that Liverpool were respectful in that case towards one of United's players, I think that just adds to their case even more. And that's why I just think it's not good at all, and it just shouldn't be stamped out. But I've heard from Liverpool fans saying how, you know, fans should be banned for this type of thing. And I just say, well, how far do you go with this situation then? Because fans, one, are 100% not going to be banned for this type of thing, because then you're going to end up banning, what, 1,000 people from a game. It's just, it's not realistic at all. And when clubs also come out,
if you've got 1,000 fans misbehaving, then should you ban 1,000 fans? Like, if you've got 1,000 fans do it, singing racist chants, for example, then do you ban that 1,000 fans? Surely, I kind of agree with you and I kind of don't agree with you at the same time, because you see this all over football. Manchester United fans will have heard songs being sung from opposition fans about the Munich air disaster. You've got Tottenham fans in their own stadium, a portion of them singing songs about the Jewish community, which are deemed offensive by some, but then for some people it's part of the identity of the football club. So I kind of see what you're saying in that you can't go, boom, you're banned because of what you've done on this occasion, because it doesn't feel that severe, if you know what I mean. I'm not downplaying what happened in any way, and I'm not downplaying the significance of the Hillsborough disaster. But at the same time, if you want to eradicate this stuff, like you and I were saying, we're going to educate fans. We're going to educate. I mean, what does that mean? What exactly are they going to do? Are they going to talk about
that? That's just their greenwashing,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, it's
never going to happen. Educating is just a way to say, we've heard it, we're acknowledging it, and we're trying to not condone it. It's basically just taking the moral high ground, isn't it? But it's not really doing much.
So short-term ban, then, is the only way to go forward, isn't it?
Well, then, this is what I mean. How far do you go with it? Do you do it for every single offensive chant, every single chant that swears in it, every single chant that's a little bit, you know, more than what is typically deemed as acceptable at a football game? And like you say, it happens everywhere in every country. I do think we do need to move on from this kind of very vulgar chanting, which just doesn't have a place in football anymore. And I don't think it should have. But like I say, football has moved on massively in 10 years, where it's all these type of things are starting to get shone on a lot more than they used to, where before it was seen as kind of banter. Whereas now it's something that's just, it's just distasteful. It's not right. And I just think it doesn't belong in football anymore, which I think is the reason why it's been clamped down on more now than ever.
This kind of verging into the no-go areas of football, Marley, has been something that's often been levelled at the non-match-going fans about the guys on social media who just watch games on telly and then talk about it with their friends via their keyboards and all that kind of thing. But are we seeing a change in fan behaviour in stadiums now, or has this always been there? I'm kind of thinking about looking at the recent example and going back to the Manchester United Liverpool game and the minute silence or the minute's applause that Liverpool fans held for as tribute or support of Cristiano Ronaldo on the 7th minute. Now, Liverpool fans on social media, there's been arguments between City and Everton and Liverpool about whether that should have happened and whether you should support a rival player in that way. But that is very much a social media argument and it feels very off colour and very distasteful. That is kind of par for the course on social media. That's the way it works on Twitter and whatnot. But here we're seeing it kind of creeping into a football stadium. Do you think there is a problem across the board with fan behaviour, or has it always been there? Am I just being really naive?
I think it's probably always been there. But with social media being such a thing, you know, you can't look at a picture of a crowd without probably 30 or 40 or 50% of them having their phones out and filming the game. So everything you possibly do is going to be caught somewhere, and somehow, like, it's going to be on Snapchat, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, whatever it is. It's probably going to be caught, and especially if you chant something, because, you know, if you chant something, you draw attention to yourself. You know, if you stand in a football crowd and shout as loud as you can, you know, how many people can hear you? You're probably talking 500 or 1,000 people can hear your voice, if you time it right, and, you know, and you're the guy who everybody knows where the thing's coming from. So it's easy enough to be pointed out like that, and you've kind of just got to hope it goes away, because it's similar to the racist thing. You know, we're probably talking this summer again about, or next year we'll probably talk again about racist chanting when England go away to an Eastern European country or something like that. And it's a similar sort of, everybody knows it's wrong, but it still happens. And I think with what Joel was saying there about, you know, the whole educating fans line, it's just a cop out really, because you can't educate somebody who already thinks it's right to, or thinks it's okay to chant about Hillsborough and and anything really, because that same fan would be absolutely fuming and furious to the point of if they wanted to attack the other player, the other fan, if that fan had been chanting about Munich to the Man United fan. Like, there's a line you don't cross, and it's there, and everybody knows where the line is, and everybody can see the line and stays away from it, really. But those little percentages who just think it's all right because it'll get them some clout on social media, and you know, people might be DMing them going, oh yeah, good, you know, nice one, mate, you know, stick it up them Reds from Merseyside, blah, blah, blah. Whatever it might be, like, they think it's justified for that, but I don't get it, to be honest, because, you know, if there's one team that can't, if there's one team and one club that knows what it's like to have a disaster happen to them, it's Man United. And it's Man United and Liverpool. So chanting each things about each other is that crosses that line is just bizarre.
It's forgotten, though, isn't it? It's like with every generation of fans that come along, it kind of moves a little bit further away. And it's almost like this is the issue, I think. I think the words that are being sung, they don't really have any meaning, be it Hillsborough or be it Munich or be it whatever is the subject of these chants. To the people who are singing them, they probably don't really appreciate the history around it, and they don't appreciate the context. It's just something that you can say that winds up the people in the other colour shirts.
Yeah, it does get watered down slightly. It happens. That's just the way things work. People think it's not as serious as it is, but you know, it's one thing that, you know, chanting about Hillsborough or whatever it might be from the comfort of your end. You know, realistically, if you're a Man United fan sat in Anfield surrounded by 2,500 other Man United fans and you chant about Hillsborough, they might not all agree with you. You know, your own fans might not all agree with you, but you're not going to get battered. You know, no one's going to turn around and say, that's too far. You know, stop being a div. They might say it, but they're not going to do anything about it. However, if you walked into one of the pubs outside Anfield and chanted that, you wouldn't leave it. You would be beaten to a pulp because that's how much it means to people. And this is what this is what people don't understand. You know, when it passes down through the generations, and sometimes when you get the day tripper fans who go to the stadium and haven't been fans, you know, all their lives and things like that, and they think, oh yeah, it's all right, this will wind them up. We're losing the game, so we'll try and wind them up. There's still a line there to adhere to and to stay behind, and too many fans just think now, ah, sod it, well, I'll say it and I'll get a bit of a reaction. But you know, if you say that in the wrong place at the wrong time, you're in serious trouble, and you'll experience that if you ever see the scenes around in the pubs around Anfield on a match day. And similarly, if you said something about Munich in Manchester on a match day, you would find out the consequences of it pretty quickly, I would think.
Do you know what? That's exactly the punishment. Let's forget about the ban situation or the education. If you were singing the songs at Manchester United about Hillsborough, you should have to go and stand on Albert Docks on your own and sing the same songs and see exactly what happens. The punishment would fit the crime, I think you've got to safely say. Right, that is it for today's Football Social Daily. As always, you can find your next favourite sport podcast at sport-social.co.uk. And we'll see you tomorrow for another dose of football stuff. Bye-bye.
Football Social Daily. Find more great sport at sport-social.co.uk.